Hello, I'm Bruce Celery. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Teaching your kids the value of money is hard. I have a kid, it's hard. But an online tool called Gifting Sense aims to teach kids about financial literacy and how to make better consumer decisions. Karen Holland is the founder of Gifting Sense, and she'll be here to talk a bit about how it works. And we'll talk about budgeting, too. There are plenty of budgeting apps out there to make your life easier, but which ones are the best? Enoch Omalulu is with Savvy Young Canadians. This is a great blog, and he's going to take us through his top five budgeting apps. And, you know, disability insurance is not a super glam topic, but it is a really important one. Lauren Marr will be here to talk about it. He's Director of Business Development at Hub Financial Inc., and he's going to make the case for why disability insurance is important and what you should be looking for as you look for a policy. And Our Crowd has a new venture capital fund that is accessible to small investors in Canada. Kind of a new twist on that space. Plus, six financial principles for financial freedom. David Ash will be here to take us through his principles and talk about his book, Simple Wealth. This is Moolala, Money Made Simple. Let's get started. Tracking your expenses is not the most fun thing in the world to do, but it is important because what gets measured gets managed. It's not easy, though. It can be a bit of a hassle. If you don't want to do it manually, there are tons of different budgeting apps out there. But which are the best? Well, here's one take. Enoch Omalulu from Savvy New Canadians is here to take us through his list that appears on his blog. And Enoch, I got to tell our listeners again, you're a veterinarian by day, personal finance blogger by night. Do you use a budgeting app yourself?
Yes, I do. I actually do use a combination just based on the different things I use them for. So I use them for tracking my expenses, income, and just keeping on top of my finances in general.
What do you think makes a good budgeting app? We're going to go through the five in your article, but what were some of the things that you were considering?
So overall, I'm looking at first and foremost as the safety. So there's nothing clad in stone when it comes to security online, but I want to be sure that it's from a legitimate company and that there are things in place to protect my account, because you're going to be linking your bank account, investment account in some cases, and then you want to be sure that those accounts are going to be protected. So the security of the platform, as well as the features. So do they actually cover what I need? If you're looking for a budget app that you want to use as a family or as a couple, does it provide those options? And or if you're looking for a free budget app, for example, the Mint app, then you want to go for something that is affordable. So it all depends on what you're looking for.
Your best overall budget app is You Need a Budget, YNAB. It's not free. It's like $12 a month or $84 a year. Why is it worth paying that amount of money, in your opinion?
So I think YNAB has some unique features that are not widespread amongst budget apps. So for YNAB, you're looking at a budget app that actually proactively helps you save money, as opposed to an app that looks back at your financial picture like last week, last month, and gives you basically an historical perspective of your finances. So YNAB is a bit different in that way, in that it's very flexible and it has a more intuitive way for budgeting. So a more intuitive system for budgeting, which is sort of unique in that industry.
One of the other things that I love about their approach is this idea of giving every dollar a job. Can you talk a bit about what that means and how that works in terms of the app?
So giving every dollar a job basically means you are looking at your income sources, and you are before you start spending, you are looking at your income sources, the amount you're going to receive from your salary, your wages, and you're saying, this is how I want to spend it. So yeah, you're telling yourself, this is how I want to spend it, and you're going to impute that into the app. So it's going to guide, once you enter that as your starting point, then it basically helps you stay on track.
Your best budget app for cash back is COHO, so this is obviously connected to a financial institution. How do you assess the quality of an app that is connected to a financial institution? Does COHO allow you to scrape all accounts regardless of financial services company, or is it limited in that way?
It's very limited. So actually, you can't really, COHO is slightly different when it comes to the budgeting side of things. It's more so, it's almost like an envelope. So it's like you're taking money, cash, instead of using a cash envelope, a physical cash envelope, you're actually putting your cash in COHO as a prepaid card and a prepaid app. And you are essentially using that app to guide your expenses or your spending. So it's slightly different. It doesn't connect to your bank account and then track your expenses or anything like that. What it does is you can take a certain amount of money, put it on the app, and then let's say I'll just give an example. Let's say I want to spend $200 for eating out this month. So I load it on my COHO card, and then that way I can basically track how I spend it. And you can also set up some budgets in it. So you can set up a financial goal and say, you know what, I want to save this amount off of every expenses or off of every purchase I make. So it can help you in that way. It's more so a combination of earning cash back, not spending credits, and doing some budgeting, but it's not like, it's not a sole budget app.
Right. Another example, your best budget app for micro investing. And for those people who aren't familiar with that concept, it's basically the idea that if you buy something for $19, it'll round up to 20 and put that one extra dollar into investment account. Correct? If I summarize that correctly?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
It also says in their marketing stuff is discover money in your daily life. What do you take that to mean, knowing more than I do about how it works?
So I think what COHO does is really a spare change investing app. So let's say you buy coffee for $2.50. The COHO app helps you automatically invest the 50 cents after rounding it up to $3. So sometimes people are like, you know what, I can't start investing because how much am I going to invest? I'm going to invest $50 or I'm going to invest 5 cents. Like I just don't have the funds to start investing. What COHO does is it helps you actually find money from almost nowhere because you are saving without actually impacting your day-to-day living. So 50 cents off of on top of your coffee and 2 cents on top of your roundup when you buy this, or $5 when you buy something else or you pay a bill, it doesn't really impact your day-to-day living. So even if you are tight on funds, you are still able to set aside some money and invest it.
Right. Your best budget app for couples is Pocket Smith. This I've heard a lot of a lot of apps. I haven't heard of this one. What distinguishes Pocket Smith?
Yeah, so Pocket Smith is pretty great if you're an expatriate and you move between countries. It's pretty great for tracking various currencies because it has an inbuilt strategy for actually managing currency exchange rates. So you can have a good picture of your finances at any moment. And it's also very great for folks who are trying to work hand in hand with their partners to budget. So it sort of has additional features that makes it attractive for those who are working on their budgeting with their partners or spouses or what have you.
Interesting. Okay, I've got one more. I've just got 30 seconds for it. The best free budget app is Mint. It's been around for a while. It does scrape accounts from your whole financial life. What do you think people should know about Mint?
So with regards to scraping your financial accounts from your banking or your investments, Mint doesn't actually give you I think it's read-only. So because I personally use Mint and I've used it for probably a decade. It doesn't give you the ability to actually do anything with that account in the sense of moving money or transferring money. So it's safe in quote in that way. And overall, it's a free app that anyone can start off with. So if you're not willing to pay monthly fees on the budgeting app, I think Mint is a great place to start.
Really interesting stuff. Enoch, thank you for your perspective. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Bruce.
The blog is called Savvy New Canadians. It's founder Enoch Omalulu, and you can check out his article on the best budgeting apps out there. Great insight.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
When I was a kid, like most other kids since the beginning of time, I begged my parents for the latest and greatest thing on the market. For me, it was the Buck Rogers action figures and the Hot Wheels car wash. Sometimes I'd get the toy and I'd play with it forever, and sometimes I'd get the toy and play with it for 2 seconds before I got bored. I have the same experience with my own kid. She's now 11. There is now this online tool called Gifting Sense that is trying to help kids make better consumer decisions. Joining me now is its founder, Karen Holland. She joins us from Utterson, Ontario. Hello there.
Hi.
Why did you invent Gifting Sense? It's brilliant, by the way. I've tried it. I've tested it out. But where did the idea come from? Why'd you put the work into it?
Well, I'm an economist by training, and I was married about 10 years before my son was born. I've always been a very efficient, my friends would say penurious individual.
Ooh,
and we had this little boy. And so we started to have first family birthday parties when he was a little guy, and then, you know, school friend birthday parties. And between school and winter holiday gift-giving scenarios, the amount of waste that I was experiencing, not only in my own family, but witnessing it in my extended family and in the friends' family settings, it really made me crazy. And I just have a thing about waste. I say to my friends, I have a serious distaste for waste.
I have the same thing.
Actually, I have to say, I spent some time getting to know you when I was approached about this interview, and I think you and I have a lot in common.
I think we have a lot in common. Okay, so I went through the Gifting Sense platform, and basically, I'll shortcut it here. You put in the item, your kid, and ideally it's the kid that does this, but I did this on behalf of my daughter. You put the item in, you can name the thing, you can put a photo up if you'd like, and then it goes through a bunch of variables, cost, and all that stuff. One of the things that it asks is, how much will you use this particular thing? How do you address the disconnect between how much someone thinks they will use a thing and how much they will actually use the thing? Because I used the remote control car that she got for her birthday, and it turned out to be $3 per use. And I thought I was generous in terms of how much she would use it.
You know, what we're really trying to do is immunize children against developing poor spending habits and all the downstream issues those create later in life. So what happens is, when kids answer these questions, and then, you know, there's an automatically generated PDF summary at the end of the gift survey. That's our pithy little name for a potential purchase questionnaire. And it shows what the calculated DIM score is and the cost per use, or if it's an experience they're looking for, the total cost of the experience, which includes, you know, safe transportation, snacks, souvenirs, because you don't just go to a Taylor Swift concert for the price of a ticket.
You need merch.
Right. When the children complete that process, they know in the privacy of their own heart if they've gamed it or not. In fact, I mean, whenever we do a workshop in a classroom, I let the teachers know, like, set your watch to it. The first thing that happens when they finish is they ask if they can do it again, because they're so intuitive and digital is so iterative. They know almost immediately if that score is in the range that their own parents are going to want it to be in, and they want to take another run at it and see if they can answer the questions differently and game their score. Does that bother me? Not at all. Because you know what they're really getting? They're getting this quick but meaningful introduction to the components of a well thought out decision. And the PDF summary, it's like their own little PowerPoint for, okay, now I'm going to go and talk to my mom and dad about, you know, why I would like this. Now, I will tell you, children are shocked to discover that they change what they want. And they're equally surprised to see how quickly their parents get behind a request when it's backed with evidence of thought.
100%. Right? You ask a bunch of other variables here that I think are worthy of including, and that is, does it get you outside? Does it involve music? Does it help you build things with your hands? How come those all make the decision set?
Because I was trying to say to children, look at your children, your parents want you to be happy. They want you to grow and develop in all sorts of positive ways. So if you want to get something, wrap it in the lessons and experiences they want you to have. I'm teaching them really, I mean, look at the rich dream is that thinking before buying becomes thinking before doing almost anything, right?
Mm. Yeah. DIMS score. There's a DIMS score, and I assume that's not dim-witted.
No, it stands for does it make sense score. And it's a number from 1 to 10. 1 to 6 is a want. 7 to 10 is a need. It's okay to buy wants. Everybody does. We just want kids to recognize the full value of what it is they're asking for and whether or not they'll really use and appreciate it before they ask for it. And you know, thinking before buying, this is the one thing I really want kids to understand. And they do when we finish a workshop, and it's so exciting. Thinking before buying does not mean you never get to buy anything fun. It means you plan your spending and avoid buyer's remorse.
There are a whole bunch of lessons here. I'd love a couple others. So financial literacy, thinking before buying, what other skills does this tool build, do you think?
Planning in advance, using your manners, being gracious. it gets you to think about the environment. I mean, one of the questions we ask kids at the end of all workshops is, okay, we hope that you realize that thinking before buying helps everyone. It helps you be thoughtful about what you ask for. It helps the people who care about you avoid wasting time and money purchasing something that you are never going to use, wear, whatever. It helps the planet. Why is that? Because landfills, as you probably know, are filled with quote unquote gently used articles of clothing or toys, earrings that never were worn or gloves or whatever. If we think before we buy, if we thoughtfully request what we might like to receive for a holiday or a birthday gift, those things don't end up in landfills. I mean, just think about what would happen if we have 50 million children in Canada and the US alone. If every one of those kids in grades 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 thought really hard twice a year before they bought something or put it on a wish list, we've got a generation of kids who are entering high school prepped. They are ready for full-on financial literacy.
I am sure you hear from parents like me who are like, oh, well, it's designed for children, but well, I'm at it. I might try it. What insight do you hear from parents? Are they horrified by their own behavior and their own thinking?
Well, I do get that a lot. I mean, it runs the gambit. I have spouses telling me that their spouse needs it. I'm like, not you, but your spouse.
Yes.
I mean, I've had all sorts of interesting conversations. I mean, some parents have said, you know, they hadn't really thought about the full cost of a night out until they were adding in safe transportation, snack, and souvenirs to experiences that their kids wanted. And they're like, you know, by the time you think about the Uber and the babysitter, forget about what it costs to go to the restaurant. So I think it's given people food for thought, but you know, look, we give kids gifts all the time. And at the same time, adults are pretty openly vocal about wishing they'd learned more about money when they were younger and, you know, the stakes were lower. And they're saying that because, you know, they've had the experience of making a financial misstep and then having to spend a lot of time digging out from it. So, you know, I just think if we could get kids into the habit of thinking before buying, they can avoid a lot of that drama. There's a thing in economics, I'm sure you're aware of it, a positive externality. A positive externality accrues when the benefit of a purchase is experienced by more than just the person who bought it. So the classic example is immunization, right? You get immunized, you don't get sick, but neither do your siblings, neighbors, cousins, classmates, whatever. Financial literacy for children who have their whole lives in front of them offers such a massive positive externality. It's good for them right now and their parents, their immediate family, and their extended family. It's good for their future employer, their future life partner. Like, think about the ripple effect of somebody getting into the habit of thinking before they buy, before they enter high school. It's massive. It's so exciting.
Genius. I'm excited. Giftingsense.org is the website. Karen, thank you so much for your time.
My absolute pleasure.
And you, also for inventing this thing. I think it's
you
genius.
Keep up your great work because you're doing some great work.
I'll do my best. Tell that to my 11-year-old. Not sure she'll
okay. Well,
me,
listen, you're 10 years away, but I promise you'll get there.
She'll appreciate me eventually.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
Karen Holland, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Bruce.
Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, I'll talk to an author named David Ash. His new book is called Simple Wealth, and he goes through 6 principles for financial freedom. The perfect dovetail, actually, to Gifting Sense. And later, why disability insurance is so important. Lauren Marr from Hub Financial will be here. Listen, if you want to stay up to date on all things Moolala, we have a very simple way to do that. It is our monthly free newsletter. It's got all the interviews that I've done on CBC Radio and CityLine and SiriusXM and BNM, Bloomberg, blah, blah, blah. It's once a month, and I will never do anything with your email address other than, you know, send you a newsletter.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, SiriusXM 167.
Everyone's financial journey comes with its ups and downs. Entrepreneur and investor David Ash has shared a few of those in his lifetime, from a bankruptcy filing in his late 20s to a period of financial freedom today. His book is called Simple Wealth, and he joins us now to talk about his 6 proven principles for financial freedom. David joins us from Surrey, British Columbia. Hello there.
Hello, Bruce.
You write that the truth is always simple. You have quite a story here. As I said, you filed for bankruptcy at 28 and you more than rebounded. What is the single most important lesson, life lesson, that informs your principles in this book?
I would say, Bruce, that financial intelligence is not to be confused with a high IQ or academic achievement.
Yeah.
That it's something that anybody can achieve no matter what their background or education or training.
You outlined 6 principles. I'm going to go through them just so that we can focus on 2 in particular. Save a percentage of all you earn, control your expenses, make money multiply, protect wealth from loss, own a home, increase your ability to earn. So those are the 6. I want to focus on own a home because that is becoming increasingly difficult in major centers these days. The increase in home prices is way outpaced the increase in incomes. How do you contextualize that principle, knowing that many of our listeners live in places in which a home is simply not available for under $1 million?
Well, I mean, that's, of course, in the book, I make it clear that owning a home, that well-selected real estate, of course, is a great investment, but that owning a home is something that is very personal and might not work for everyone for a number of reasons. One of them might be the reason you've just described. Costs of real estate have become very high in some of our major centers relative to incomes. However, if someone is really set on the idea and their income is limited, a lot of people are being very creative and they're partnering with family members. We're seeing young people, often parents are sometimes bequeathing inheritances early to give their children down payments or equity necessary to buy a home. People are partnering with each other. And or if you really want to own a home, sometimes it's just a matter of changing location, moving out to the suburbs or someone further away. If you want to stay in a big city like a Vancouver or a Toronto and you don't have the income, then that's just something that you're going to have to postpone or perhaps not participate in.
Of the 6, that is the one that really is the most deeply connected to privilege, right? Because most people statistically do not have parents who are able to cut the check for the down payment of 50 to 100 grand.
Correct. That's
now,
true.
You're a big believer in rental properties and rental income. Great idea in principle. The math can be really tough to make work, though, given the aforementioned crazy increase in the price of real estate. Rents have not kept pace with home prices in a lot of places. And the condo market has had a huge pullback in terms of, you know, the declining rent and in terms of the vacancy rate in some places tripling. How do you think through rental properties, knowing the market dynamics of today?
You know, Bruce, real estate, like any other investment, it's always about well-selected real estate. I don't advocate buying any type of property for that purpose. So, I mean, it's a very careful study and an analysis comparing the cost of carrying to your income and your future capacity has to be done. And whether or not a person's prepared to do the work necessary to deal with the tenants and all the rest of it. I know many young people starting out who are enjoying the benefits of owning rental properties. It's a reach, it's a challenge, it's a sacrifice, but it's an investment in their future that they're willing to make, and it pays off in the long run.
I want to come back to the principle around increasing one's ability to earn. Tell us more about that. What are the levers that one can pull?
Well, whatever you do, it doesn't matter what you're doing for a living. I think always be looking for that next best opportunity in the context that you're currently in. If you're a street sweeper, be the best street sweeper you can be. Always look for ways to improve upon the income, the earning where you are at the time. And then also, I think it's important to always have your antenna up, looking for better opportunities elsewhere. And to always, of course, further educate yourself and take that chance on that new opportunity. Don't get stuck in a job that's going nowhere with very limited opportunity. Keep moving forward. Always look for ways to increase your ability to earn.
In the acknowledgments, you thank God, saying, you know, the richest friend you got is the richest friend you have. What role would you say your faith has played in your financial life?
Well, the role it plays, I think, has altered my perspective in terms of how I approach the management of my wealth from one of purely wealth for wealth's sake to one of stewardship, where the handling of the wealth and the way we use the wealth is done in a way that is consistent, hopefully, with the principles that we live by as people of faith.
Your mother was someone who dealt with mental health issues for a long period of time. You write about that in such a compelling and moving way in the book. Tell us a bit about that and how that is informed how you think about money and also how you think about philanthropy.
Yeah, my mother, as I mentioned in the book, passed away in 1999. She struggled with mental illness and died alone in a rooming house in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Of course, that, shaped us, my brothers and I. And I think when you experience a traumatic event like that, you look at life through a different set of eyes. You see the people that you pass on the sidewalks that are panhandling differently. And of course, it marks you and has, in our case at least, given us a deeper appreciation for the challenges that people face, whether it's mental illness or drug addiction or just straight up homelessness. We were able to appreciate it and relate to it. So we invest a fair bit of time and energy in supporting those kinds of causes in our city and other cities around the world.
I mentioned that there are six principles. I went through them off the top. I said own a home is the one that's probably the hardest to wrap your mind around if your circumstances are tougher. But the rest really are, they transcend education and income bracket. If you could snap your fingers and change one behavior in society at large such that 32 million Canadians could embrace the principles that you have outlined, what would it be?
It would be to embrace that people would be embrace the idea of short-term sacrifice for long-term gain, to understand that they can achieve, most of us think that we can achieve a lot more in a year than we can, and we underestimate how much we can achieve in 10 or 20 years. So an appreciation for the idea that a short-term sacrifice really does provide you with a long-term gain, and to take joy, find a joy in taking that.
David, thank you for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Bruce. Really appreciate you having me.
David Ash is the author of Simple Wealth. In terms of time, I will say it is not a long read. He is very focused on these six principles and some really powerful context around them. but it's not going to take you a lot of time. Simple Wealth was just released this year. Stay with us. Coming up next on Moolala, Our Crowd's first ever venture capital fund accessible to small investors in Canada. I'll speak to David Shore to find out how it works. And later, Karen Holland, founder of Gifting Sense, will be back to take our Moolala questionnaire. If you'd like a little bit more Moolala, you can get full episodes of the show on whatever podcast platform you currently listen to your podcasts on. You can also go to moolala.ca to search for individual segments by topic. While you're on your podcast platform, please feel free to write us a review, subscribe even, so the next one will arrive right to your device.
You're listening to Moolala, Money Made Simple, with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
Venture capital funds are simply not accessible to most Canadians. If you want a piece of the next Shopify before it becomes all caps Shopify, the most valuable company in Canada, as it did back in May, you're not likely going to get the opportunity, except maybe now. Our Crowd is a global venture investing platform. It's just launched its first ever venture capital fund accessible to small investors in Canada. David Shore is Our Crowd's Vice President of Investor Relations, and he joins us now. Hello there.
Hi, how are you doing?
What is this fund, and why did you think it was worth your time and energy to make it available more broadly than just to the pension funds and wealthy individuals that normally focus on VCs?
So the operating mantra for Our Crowd is democratizing access to venture capital. So we got started about 8 years ago, and the genesis for the idea of the company is to be able to bring access to an asset class that historically, as you say, has been restricted just to the largest institutions or the wealthiest investors in the world. And what we've done is introduce access at a minimum investment point that is much, much lower than you would typically be required to invest in a standard VC fund.
Financial services are notoriously highly regulated. What was the number one regulatory hurdle you had to overcome in order to make this happen?
So we had to get registered as an exempt market dealer. So we are registered with the securities commissions in Canada, in all the major provinces. So we fall under the securities commissions here and have to follow the regulations. And that allows us to deal with the individual investors and financial advisors in Canada.
What is the average dollar ring for an individual investor? Are people parking 20 grand in there? Are they parking 2 million in there? And parking, I shouldn't say, because I'm sure you make it that money rev very, very hard, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, so it ranges significantly. We have individual investors who are investing in, as you say, the tens of thousands of dollars. We have family offices that are investing with us in the $500,000 to $5 million range, and then we have institutions that are investing in the millions of dollars with us as well.
So the money gets put in the fund. From that point on, does it operate like any VC fund in terms of sourcing business ideas, signing deals, getting a piece of an early stage business?
Yes, but with some interesting wrinkles. So the Our Crowd 50 Fund, which is the one that we just launched the new feeder for here in Canada, is not like your typical VC fund in several ways. First of all, as the name implies, we are investing in 50 different companies within the fund. Your typical VC fund would be usually around 15 to 20 companies. It's also very diversified across stages, sectors, and geographies. So we are investing around the world in all sectors of technology from early to late stage. And we're providing that access to the investors here in Canada. And the other thing that makes a little bit different with the venture fund is that your typical VC fund takes 12 months, 18 months, maybe 2 years to raise. They'll take 3 to 5 years to deploy the capital, and then 4 years later they'll come back and raise their next fund. The OC50 fund, we are raising the funds generally in 6 months or less. We're deploying that capital because of our very, very robust deal flow, generally in under 2 years. And then we immediately, as soon as we've finished raising the first fund, then we immediately will close that and then launch a second fund. So the fund would always be available, and we're able to deploy the capital very quickly. And we actually start returning the capital back to investors, which is what investors want to see, generally quicker than you would see with other funds.
The pro of your diversification approach, so not 15, but 50, means you diversify, hooray. The con is that you wouldn't have sector or regional expertise in the way that a traditional VC would. How do you overcome that? That seems like a negative.
Well, we have a very big team to start with. We're almost 200 people globally. And, you know, we think the upside in not having to chase, you know, a hot sector or a particular fad means that we can really just be smart about where we are investing. So, you know, funds that have very, very specific mandates have to invest in those types of companies, in those sectors, in those geographies, in those stages, no matter what the valuations look like. If, you know, companies are trading at 2x revenue or 50x revenue, they have to deploy capital, which can make it much harder to generate significant returns. We can look at a sector like that and saying, you know, technology is interesting, but the valuations don't make sense, and we'd rather deploy into other areas. We do have people with specific domain expertise, both internally in the company, as well as a network of advisors that we work with to help us make our due diligence decisions.
Canadians are learning more and more about fees. They still aren't really clear about getting value for the price that they pay, but at least they know it for a fee-based world, it's, call it 1%. For a Canadian equity MER, it's, you know, 2.3%, something like that. A traditional VC might have a management fee of 2.5 and a carry of, say, 20. How does the fee structure work for you?
So we also operate on that same type of model where there's a management fee and a carry. The OC50 fund actually has a 1.5% management fee and a 20% carry after investors get back their full investment, including whatever fees they've paid.
How do you think about performance, knowing there's a massive asterisk here that, you know, historical performance is not indicative of the future, or whatever the legal phraseology is? We know that a broad-based Canadian equity investment, a diversified investment, is going to be, you know, 5-7% over the course of years, an annual return of about that over the course of years. How do you think about performance?
So we're targeting what we would call top quartile VC returns. So annual compound returns in the 20% range.
Very different game.
Yes. Obviously, there's you know, a lot more risk involved, as you mentioned. You know, we see hundreds of companies in our deal flow pipeline every month. We do significant due diligence on the companies that are of interest. We'll end up investing in about 1% of the companies that we see. And even then, knowing that, you know, there is risk that the companies we invest in, despite the due diligence and despite the help we give the companies, won't necessarily be successful. So it's very, very important for investors to be diversified within the asset class, which is why the OC50 fund is a very good fit for that.
What type of account is your fund best found in? I mean, some people would say, oh, it sounds like great for long-term retirement savings. Could it go in an RRSP? Should it be for a TFSA? Should it be in your non-registered account?
Yes. So the new feeder fund we actually launched last week is designed to be available inside an RRSP or TFSA. You know, these are long-term illiquid investments, and we think it matches very, very nicely with the time horizon exactly of an RRSP or a TFSA.
On that point, how do you exit?
So there's no redemption in the fund itself. There's no secondary market, for example. But what we do is we provide liquidity to investors from the proceeds of exits. So OC50 number one, the first fund in the series that we launched, was launched in 2017, invested in 50 companies in under 2 years, has already had 6 exits out of the portfolio, 2 companies that went public, 4 companies that were acquired. We've already returned back to investors about 20% of their capital, even though it's very early in the fund's life cycle. And that does not include the proceeds from our investment in Lemonade, which had a extremely successful IPO late in the year.
Interesting. David, thanks for joining us to talk about this.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
David Shore is Vice President of Investor Relations with a firm called Our Crowd. And the hook here is VC access for everyone. Interesting model. Hey, listen, much more ahead on the show. Coming up next, why you might need disability insurance. Lauren Marr will be here. He's with Hub Financial. And then we'll take Karen Holland through the Moolala questionnaire. She's the founder behind financial literacy website Gifting Sense. Now, lots of different ways to get great money context out there. I'm on CityLine, a daily lifestyle show on air across North America. You can find all those segments at cityline.ca. Then search for me.
You're listening to Moolah Law, Money Made Simple with Bruce Ellery on Canada Talks, Sirius XM 167.
There are some crazy statistics out there about the very high percentage of Canadians who will spend at least some portion of their life disabled. Maybe not necessarily permanently, but for a period of time, the stats are high. And yet many Canadians are ill-prepared for that scenario, because certainly not all Canadians have disability insurance. Many don't think they need it, or they don't know much about it, or they think they've got all the coverage they need at their work. Lauren Marr is the Director of Business Development at Hub Financial. He's here to tell us why we might need disability insurance and what we should be looking for when we go shopping. Hello, Lauren. How you doing?
Good, Bruce.
Why is disability insurance so important for Canadians, in your opinion?
I mean, I think it's very important, and a lot of people underestimate it, is because you just hit upon it. The chances of becoming disabled are very high. In fact, the chances of someone becoming disabled, you know, who's say 40 years old over a 10-year window, is much, much higher than the chances of them dying over that 10-year window. So that's, I mean, one crucial reason is that the likelihood of it happening is very high. Mm. And then, you know, a lot of Canadians, as you mentioned, also don't have the financial safety net in place to weather that disability. So that's another reason why it's crucially important.
What's the ballpark cost? Kind of like, you know, for a 40-year-old, like $200 to $300 or so? What influences that cost?
The cost is influenced by a few things. So it's really disability insurance. It is pretty hard to give a ballpark because it's influenced on the person's age, their smoking status, their health, their gender. And interestingly enough, with gender, it's the opposite of life insurance. Females, on average, pay more for disability insurance than males because females live longer, but their chances of becoming disabled are greater. The other variable is the person's occupation. So unlike life insurance, where a 40-year-old male pays the same if they're a chiropractor, or if they're a landscaper, a 40-year-old male would pay less for disability insurance, generally if they're a professional, versus a blue-collar worker, because the incidence of disability is higher on a blue-collar worker.
And when you use the word disability, how broad a term is it? Do mental health challenges factor in? What are the...
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, really, disability would be anything that's preventing you from earning an income. So if you're due to an injury or an illness, so if you're off work from depression, if you're off work from bad back, those would both be disabilities. Now, what you have to be very careful of is, does your plan have any exclusions? So if someone's applying for a plan and they have a history of depression, there may be an exclusion for depression, so they have to check that out. And same thing with a bad back or a bad knee. If you're coming into the plan, into an individual plan with an illness or with an injury, that may not be covered.
I don't have a job, so I knew I would need LTD, and I, you know, sought it out. I got the estimates and I bought it ages ago. But a lot of people have jobs, and they probably think that the task is complete because they're with an employer. What questions should those people be asking themselves to see if the coverage that they have through a workplace is sufficient?
There's a couple of big things that I would look at. One is, does your plan, what's the definition of disability under your plan? A lot of plans go to any occupation after 2 years. So what that means is that if you could do any type of work, you're not going to be covered. So if you look at like a pharmacist, you know, they may have a plan that goes to any occupation. So for the first 2 years, they'd be covered. But if after 2 years they could work as a grocery clerk, then they wouldn't be covered because the definition changed to any occupation. Another big thing is there a cap on the monthly benefit? So, you know, someone who's earning, let's say, you know, $10,000 a month, a higher income earner, may have a cap of $3,000 or $4,000 on their plan. So they're only covering a very small percentage of their income.
What should people know about the difference between disability insurance and critical illness coverage? Because they work very differently and there are pros and cons to both.
Yeah, it's a good question. The disability insurance is replacing your income. So that's essentially, you can think of disability insurance as income replacement insurance. So someone who's retired or someone who's not working generally can't get disability insurance because there's no income to replace. Whereas critical illness insurance is linked to the person developing a critical illness like cancer, stroke, heart disease, or cancer, stroke, heart attack, paralysis, some type of major illness or some type of severe injury would pay out a lump sum benefit. It's not tied to your income. So someone who's not working could still qualify for a critical illness plan. Also, someone who's in a hard to insure occupation could qualify for a critical illness plan.
The application process, I mean, it's critical that you are completely above board in your answers there, I am sure. What are the actions that a policyholder needs to take to reduce the risk that a claim will be denied?
Well, the first thing, obviously, is to answer the questions honestly, but part of that can be a little bit of a red herring because sometimes they don't know the answer to the question. So if you're unsure of the question and you need clarification, you know, make sure you ask your broker and or the insurance company, get your response in writing, and the person may have to go to their doctor and get the answer to that question because they may not know the answer to the question. So that's definitely something that I would look at, is to make sure that you understand the application questions. If there's any exclusions or any clauses within the policy that you're not sure of, same thing. Make sure you get your response in writing from the broker or preferably the insurance company.
One of the concerns that many people would have is that they are getting sold a policy that is a fit for them, that it's not too much and it's not too little. And there can be some skepticism, right? Given that an insurance broker is paid to sell the biggest and best policy possible. What has your warning lights go off if you were to eavesdrop on a sales conversation that another insurance broker was having with a potential client? What would you be like, wait, I would never do that. Don't do that. And I am saying, or I'm asking this question based on my assumption and my personal experience, having interviewed you a lot over the years, that you hold yourself to a very high standard of integrity.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I would make sure that you know, I'd be leery of anyone who's not factoring in other coverages that you have. You know, how long you're going to be until your retirement. You know, that is not, you know, getting into the details on the application questions, somebody who might try and skip over an application question to get an application approved. I'd definitely be leery of that. And, you know, make sure that there's all those questions asked in terms of outside coverages too. Because if you do have a plan at work and you're not mentioning that, you could be paying for a coverage that's not going to pay out because the coverage you have individually has to work in conjunction to your individual policy.
Right. Lauren, I really appreciate your time today.
Oh, my pleasure.
Lauren Marr, Director of Business Development at Hub Financial, Inc. Our focus was on disability insurance. If you're not sure you need it, go find out. You'll be happy that you did. Time now for the Moolala questionnaire. This is our series of questions about money, much like the Purse Questionnaire in Vanity Fair. Karen Holland is our guest. She is the founder of Gifting Sense, which is this amazing platform for financial literacy for kids. Hello there, Karen.
Hi, Bruce.
How would you describe your money personality?
Frugal.
Frugal. Okay. And would this, like, if you were to wind back the tape to childhood, 'twas ever thus?
Oh, yes. My mother said I was born 40.
My parents said the same too. Hello, old soul. Who was your money mentor growing up?
Oh, my mother.
And what were some of her behaviors that you know, now in the full light of day as a grown up, you go like, ugh, I'm my mother.
Well, you know, at the time, I was not gracious and I thought she was cheap. But of course now I'm older and I think she was truly wise, and she taught my sisters and I to think before we buy, and she set us up for a peaceful life. So God bless her.
What is one of your spending pleasures? So, of course, you think about it before you spend it, but it is something that, you know, is more than a loaf of bread and gives you great happiness.
Oh, I love fantastic cookware, which, you know, the Bay often, I mean, when the Bay has a sale, they have an SALE.
And you right. You're backing up the hatchback to fill it with.
Right. So I love like
a set.
Yes. Le Creuset. Listen. Once you've had a French Dutch oven, there's no going
you,
back.
You can't even go back. I have a fake one, an imitation one, and I'm sure that was my major error.
I have to say, and I even ponied up for the chicken handle, the knob, and it sits on the middle of my stove, and it just makes me happy every time I see it.
Oh my gosh. What does financial freedom mean to you?
You know, it's funny. I mean, I get that question a lot. I will tell you, I think I experienced it in its fullest as a parent. I mean, my husband and I, you know, we're very well matched, and we've just always spent less than we've made. But we have been very grateful that we were always able to do for our son what we thought was best for him versus what we could swing, if you will.
What is one, you know, broadly defined, one area of personal finance that you could talk about, think about, write about, speak about every single day and never get sick of it?
Spending patterns are habits, nothing more.
And what do you wish you could just take away from the discourse around money and never have to talk about it again, or at least outsource the conversation to someone else who's passionate about it?
Well, I don't think anybody makes enough money no one has carte blanche. Nobody makes enough money to not be thoughtful about it. I think that, you know, kids, we encounter this a lot, right, when we're in schools. Kids dream about being a professional athlete or a celebrity. And a lot of that is tied to the fact that they practice what we call strong financial offense. They make a lot of money. But, I mean, look at all those celebrities and professional athletes who've declared personal bankruptcy, because it's not enough to make money. Mm. You have to look after what you make. And similarly, you know, look at, you hear about people who had very modest incomes and, you know, left these massive art collections or, you know, sent other people's children to college or whatever. I mean, it's, you need both. You need financial offense, but you also need the defense. I think there's a myth.
You have lived experience in the game of working with a child to try and build financial literacy. What lessons were easily learned and what lessons were difficult in your family?
Well, I mean, saying no is hard, right? I mean, it's actually a relief. Our son is 21. So, I mean, he totally gets now that it was a lot more work to say no. And you know, here's why we're saying no than just say yes. But, I mean, it just pays off. Everything worthwhile is work. I wish it wasn't so, but that's the case. And it's the same with all these money conversations, but you've got to have them. And then, you know, eventually you get to the point where they start to pay you back, and you see your own kids being responsible and making good decisions, which is fantastic.
I look forward to the day. Now, as you, I look forward to it. It's coming. You are an economist, so you have an academic perspective, a practical perspective on many, many theories in the broad economic world. What is one that you wish you could have Canadians internalize? So it is a grand theory. There are books written about it, but you wish people just behaved in that way.
Oh, the government is just like a household. If they spend more than they make, they have to make up the shortfall. Right. I mean, there's that classic, you know, healthcare is free in Canada. No, it's not. It's not free. Yeah. Look at your pay stub. See that big number in the top left-hand corner?
Right.
See that much smaller number in the bottom right-hand corner? That's quote unquote free healthcare. It makes me insane when people say healthcare is free here. It is not free.
Yeah, it is not free. It's included, but you pay for it. It's like Club Med when people think the buffet is free. That is
exactly
free. Why you pay $10,000 a person.
Get with purchase of your tax burden.
Karen, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Bruce.
Karen Holland, founder of Gifting Sense. She was doing the Moolala questionnaire. That is it for our show today. If you want to stay up to date on all things MooLaLa, don't forget to subscribe to our newsletter at the website, moolala.ca. And subscribe to the podcast version of this show, too. You could even leave a review. If you have comments or questions or thoughts about this show or anything, you know, existential, ask@moolala.ca is the email address. ask@moolala.ca. On social media, at Bruce Celery, Twitter, Bruce Celery MooLaLa on Facebook. Thanks for joining us and have a great day.